Mr. George Keane, Real H, you're telling me how you were closely packed in this lifeboat after full of people and oranges, from the sound of it.
Full of people and oranges, yes. And endeavouring to keep contact with other lifeboats. The ship was still afloat when we last saw her, disappearing quite a long way away from us. And, of course, eventually she did sink. However, what we were concerned about at the time was whether any SOS had been sent out, and we afterwards learnt that it had. And in fact, it was about 12 hours later when destroyers arrived from Cape Town, and you've got that bit wrong. The destroyers arrived from Cape Town. But in the meantime, a small Polish ship had arrived and picked us all up. Personally, I was not very happy about this, because we'd all been accommodated in a very modern lifeboat, which I think we could have sailed to South Africa quite easily between us. And the Polish ship that picked us up was a coal burner with huge amounts of coal piled on the upper deck on its way to Trinidad, and I had the feeling that one torpedo and the lot of us were going to disappear very, very fast. I well remember that the ship's cook was a bit overwhelmed by this new load on board his ship, and he could only produce enough food for the women and children. Myself, amongst the coal, I found an old condensed milk tin with the top partly cut open by whoever had used it, and I went down to the boiler room where the crew had this huge black pot steaming in front of the fire doors, and got my tin filled with tea. And somebody gave me a strip of biltong, that is South African dried deer meat, and I chewed this for the couple of days until we arrived back in Cape Town. That's all I got to eat. On arrival in Cape Town, we were sent to an RAF camp at Pietermaritzburg. Okay, Pietermaritzburg. And I remember myself and a mate, we went into the canteen there, and the lady said that all she got was kippers and fried eggs, and we were highly delighted to have kippers and fried eggs. It's the only time in my life I've ever had kippers and fried eggs to eat, but we would have eaten the backside of a horse if we could have got it then. We were accommodated in tents, and it was about 3 or 4 weeks later. We were quite happy while we stayed there, because compared to what we'd had in the previous 2 years, the food was out of this world. And it was the first time that for over 2 years that I'd seen fresh milk to drink. However, the time came when we were sent down to the docks for the trip, to continue our trip to the United Kingdom in the Maloja. M-A-M-A-L-O-J-A, an old ship with reciprocating engines, as opposed to the other type. And when we arrived on board, I'm in our various states of dress or undress, and whatever we'd managed to pick up while we're in South Africa, we looked more like a bunch of pirates than smart chief and petty officers. And before we sailed, a gentleman arrived on board who was a somewhat ancient commander, Royal Navy, who'd been the naval officer in charge at one of the Indian ports, and he was on his way home to retire. Well, when he saw us and realised who we were, his eyes nearly popped out of his head, and he wanted to know why we were in the state we were. When we explained it to him, he went ashore to the local naval authorities, and I don't know what he said to them, but not long afterwards, a lorry arrived with soap and tobacco and clothing, and we picked out what fitted us. In my case, I had a pair of trousers that were at half mast and a jacket with my arms sticking out the ends, but at least we looked like naval ratings again. And we had an uneventful passage to Liverpool in convoy.
So when did you get back? About October, November?
No, it was November. November. I'd have to look at my naval documents to tell you that date. I arrived home in Liverpool towards the end of November.
Now, what happened then?
I went straight back to my depot at Chatham, where I drew a new kit, including clothes that fitted, and then went on a fortnight's leave. At the end of that fortnight, I went to the signal school, back to the signal school at Chatham, where I was there for two or three weeks, and then I was drafted to recommission the Hotspur destroyer, which had also arrived home from the Mediterranean and had been repaired. And we commissioned her as a senior officer of an escort group in the North Atlantic.
Which escort group, do you remember?
Yeah, C4, C for Charlie 4 escort group, which was a Canadian group. We went to...
And where were you based?
Well, as was... over the course of years, a special base had been developed at Tobermory in Scotland, where newly commissioned ships destined for the North Atlantic went for two or three weeks, very special, concentrated training. This was very necessary because at that time, crews were being... the numbers of regulars on board the crews were becoming small in contrast to the number of hostilities-only ratings carried. We did our a successful working up, and then we went to sea, and my captain at the time was Commander MacKillop as senior officer of this group. The other ships in the group were one old American destroyer and two or three corvettes. And our main base became St. John's in Newfoundland.
That was where you were based?
That's where we were based. St. John's in Newfoundland and Londonderry over this side. And we worked as convoy escorts on the North Atlantic until we were withdrawn.
Now, what do you remember of the period on convoy escorts? What was it
like?
Well,
the period in which I worked on convoy escort, our particular convoys had fairly quiet voyages to the other side of the Atlantic, the western side to the eastern side of the States and to Newfoundland, fairly quiet because, as has been well recorded in the history books, by the time we got to sea in about the end of March 1943, our defences were getting on top of the U-boats, and many had been sunk and a lot withdrawn. And all our voyages, every voyage that I took part in, escorting both both going east to going west to America and coming east, coming back, were very quiet except for the terrible weather.
Now, what was the weather like?
Oh, it was horrible. North Atlantic. Oh, I don't recommend the North Atlantic in winter anybody.
Well, how bad is it? Give us an idea so people get...
It is very difficult to overstate the bad weather in the North Atlantic in winter. And very often, it usually took us from 6, 7, or 8 days to take a convoy from England to the point off Newfoundland, where we left the convoys to split up and carry on to the American ports. During that time, we were very fortunate if we could get more than two or three hours good sleep at any time, night or day. And when we left port, our usual routine when we left port was to get in the petty officer's mess, was to have a big black pot filled up with tins of meat and veg, which was taken up to the galley, and when it was brought down to the mess for us to have our meals, it was tied up with a piece of rope to one of the steel girders on the bulkhead. It was almost impossible to sit down and eat a meal on a plate at any time. And I have a very clear recollection of one little incident where in our particular mess we had a set of aluminium clothes lockers down the centre of the mess. These were about 6 foot tall. And I was sitting at the base of these with one arm round a steel stanchion, eating my supper out of a tin bowl, when a kitten, which somebody brought on board, which was sitting on top of the lockers, started sliding down the tops of the lockers, owing to the fact that the bows of the ship had jumped up in the air, and it slid straight off the end of these lockers straight down into my bowl. So the kitten had more of my supper than what I had, and I always felt very sorry for lads who'd been called up for the war and had volunteered for the Navy and came to join us on board destroyers. I mean, it must have seemed like leaping straight into hell, especially up the North Atlantic.
Was the Hotspur a dry ship, or was it wet below decks?
It was fairly dry below decks, yes. It's fairly dry.
Now, how long were you on these convoys? I mean, you said it was fairly routine, except for the very bad weather. The convoys weren't attacked that you were on.
That I travelled in, no. We were very lucky, mind you. As I say, they were just getting on top of the U-boats and giving them a right good hammering then. The one thing I remember well about my particular time on the Hotspur was that the captain, first lieutenant, and the engineer officer were Royal Navy. All the other officers were Canadian. Very good, very well educated men, but some of them had never seen a ship before until they joined the Navy and had a very brief course as an officer. In fact, what they knew about the Navy could probably be written on the back of a postage stamp. And they had no idea of naval routine, and their attitude was that when you got in harbour, it was playtime for them, and it was the captain, the first lieutenant, and the chiefs and petty officers that ran the ship. There's no doubt about that. Mind you, I enjoyed it. The feeling of power.
Now, how long did this period go on for on the Atlantic Convoys? From March to...
We were withdrawn from the North Atlantic on... 1944 was June, wasn't it?
For D-Day.
About 6 weeks before D-Day. Initially based on Gladstone Dock, Liverpool, where with the captain, navigation officer, and myself attended a course on the mock-up of the North Atlantic, which is used for training in the U-boat warfare. Actually, it was a bit late for us at Birkenhead, but this only lasted for a few days before we were sent down to Plymouth to be in readiness to take up positions at the western end of the channel. Act as more or less a cork in a bottle at that end of the channel to stop any submarines or German destroyers, which were known to be on the French coast, to come and attack the ships taking part in the landings.
So what do you remember of that during the...
Of course, when we were withdrawn from the as an escort group in the North Atlantic, Commander MacKillop, our captain, left us to go and command a Holy Canadian destroyer flotilla. And his relief was a gentleman called Lieutenant Commander Landman.
Landman?
Yeah, Landman. Who had never been to sea before during the war, but had been employed at the anti-submarine training school in Portland. And it was very obvious that, of course, the yeoman of signals on board was always recognised as being a man who was well up in whatever news was going. And the question I was frequently asked when it was known who was coming, do you know who he is? Do you know what he's like? And we knew very little about him except the fact that he'd never been to sea. And we were very concerned about this. And there was an occasion when, while we're in harbour at Plymouth, when he sent for me one day and... told me that the Home Fleet were escorting the carriers in the North Sea to carry out a strike on the Tirpitz, and that they wanted a spare destroyer that could go and relieve any of the escorting destroyers who probably had to go into Iceland for refueling, and that we'd been selected. And he said he understood that I'd had a lot of experience with fleet work, and he was telling me this so that I could train my lads accordingly, ready for working with a fleet if should we be required to join the Home Fleet on this strike. And the peculiar thing was, he said to me, this was for my information only, and I was not to discuss it with the petty officer telegraphist, who, of course, was in charge of the other side of our communications. So when I went down the mess for my tot on that occasion, I said to the petty officer telegraphist, I said, now, look, I'm not supposed to tell you this, so you don't know anything about it. And he said, well, he sent for me and told me the same thing, and I wasn't to discuss it with you. So we came to the conclusion we had a most peculiar man for a captain. And this was borne out one night when four of us were doing a sweep in the early hours of the morning off the Channel Islands in line abreast. And we heard an aircraft buzzing round, and from my experience, I knew that it was a German aircraft by the sound of the engines. So I shouted out to the captain what I thought it was, and he said, he told me to fire our RAF recognition signal. And I was very loath to do this. I told him again I was absolutely certain that was an enemy aircraft, and he insisted on me firing the recognition signal, which I did. The aircraft buzzed round a bit, and the next thing was, from one of the other destroyers came a report over our radio that two torpedoes were sailing past her down her side. So the next time we got in harbour, the captain sent for me again and said that it was obvious that with my war experience, I recognised things that he didn't, and if I saw anything I should tell him, would I please tell him? Well, this attitude more or less was noticed by various other people, and eventually, on our return to Liverpool, the medical officer saw Commander-in-Chief Western Approaches, and the captain was relieved.
Now, anything else about your time on the
Although we were at the western end of the channel, operating mostly opposite the Channel Islands, it was not a very healthy spot to be, as the Channel Islands were very well defended with German shore batteries, and on one occasion they straddled us at 15 miles out in the channel. As soon as we didn't experience anything in the way of any enemy action ourselves, and not the Hotspur and the three or four other destroyers with us, during our period of patrols until the army was getting well into inland and things had quietened down, when we were sent to Barrow to be decommissioned and the ship to be prepared to be sold to the Dominican Navy. After dealing with running down my department, and those of you who've seen the pictures of the dockyard at Barrow on the television may have noticed this enormous crane, which has been there for donkey's years and was used. And whilst dealing with getting rid of the stores in my department, I had two tea chests which I'd obtained and packed with copies of my signals accumulated over our commissions to be sent off to the Admiralty. To get them out of the ship, I went along to this huge crane, had a word with the driver, gave him a couple of packets of cigarettes, and he rolled his crane down opposite the ship, and down came this enormous hook arrangement on which I tied my two little tea boxes full of signals to lift them onto the quay to put them in the lorry. I often think of that when I see this on telly, you know, commenting on the ships at Barrow.
Now, when was the ship decommissioned? What month would that be, roughly?
I think it was November. As far as I can remember, this was in November. Because I was sent down to my barracks at Chatham, and without looking at my service papers, I think I was in barracks for Christmas. But it wasn't very long before I was dispatched to Liverpool to join a troop ship and sent to Colombo in what was then Ceylon to relieve the yeoman of signals on the destroyer HMS Redoubt.
Now, what was the voyage out like? Do you remember the name of the troop ship?
Reina del Pacifico, Queen of the Pacific.
And what was that journey out like?
Quiet, very quiet. Had no problems at all on the way to way out there.
And
on arrival at Colombo, I went to the HMS High Flyer.
Which That's the shore base. Isn't
shore
it?
Base there, to await the Redoubt arriving back from a refit in Cape Town. And as soon as she arrived back, I went on board and relieved the yeoman there, and then we sailed to join the fleet at Tringamalee.
The Pacific Fleet?
East Indies. The East Indies fleet is at Trincomalee.
Sorry, of course, yeah.
Where we were and then we started taking part in the operations down off the Arakan and Burma Malaya coast, often with cruisers and escorting the carriers for airstrikes on Sumatra and other places down there.
And anything you remember in particular about those operations?
There was one operation where we were patrolling off the Andaman Islands. A Japanese reconnaissance aircraft reported a Japanese ship somewhere in the vicinity of one of the Andaman Islands, and we were steaming towards it with one other of our flotilla to try and find it. But we found the ship all right, or what remained of it, but unfortunately a Liberator bomber had got there first and dropped a couple of bombs on it. And the one thing I remember about this is the Japanese seaman in the water. And of course, Jolly Jack, being what he is, was throwing a rope over the side, but they wouldn't have anything to do with us. And we saw them being torn to pieces by sharks. Another occasion, one night, we up on not far from Rangoon, we came across this small ship which was manned by Malays with a couple of Japanese soldiers in charge, and we knocked it to pieces with our 4.7 inch guns, as there was one fella on the upper deck with a upper deck of the boat with a machine gun, and he had to be knocked off because that was the only way to stop him machining our upper deck. And we picked up the Malays, and it took them about 2 hours to settle down in the stoker's mess deck, and before they were very successfully playing cards with the stokers. I've never come across anybody like the Malays. When I heard that they'd built a motor car factory in Malaya, I thought, well, it can't be the Malays working in it, it must be the Chinese.
Anything else about the operations?
No, we didn't see the Japanese. By the time I joined the East Indies fleet, the Japanese were more or less retreating down the Malaya Peninsula, and the couple of their navy ships that were our side of the Indian Ocean, is more or less to put it, had been dealt with by forces other than our own. We had one or two attacks by Japanese aircraft, and
what do you remember of that?
Not a great deal, because